Welcome back to Insights Now. I'm David Kelly, Chief Global Strategist here at JP Morgan Asset Management. As we usher in a new year, the investment landscape is almost certainly set to change. That's why in our 12th season of Insights Now, titled Preparing for the Path Forward, I sit down with portfolio managers and strategists from across JP Morgan to discuss their key takeaways from 2024 and what they expect from the economy and markets in 2025. With the new year just around the corner, tune in to hear what opportunities we are most excited about and what risks we are most mindful of heading into the new year. With the US election in the rearview mirror and the Federal Reserve finally easing policy, the forces driving financial markets in 2025 could differ greatly from 2024. Policy uncertainty should step in for election uncertainty, and the monetary policy debate will center around how quickly the Fed will cut, not when it will begin cutting. Still, with the US economy displaying impressive resilience, and structural tailwinds supporting prospects abroad, there remain a wide variety of attractive opportunities for investors to consider across global stocks and bonds, and plenty of ways to diversify. That said, markets move quickly. Investors striving for alpha should be active in portfolios and allocate to their highest conviction ideas instead of sitting passively on the sidelines. To share some of his highest conviction ideas for the year ahead, I'm excited to be joined by Phil Camporelli, Portfolio Manager in our Multi-Asset Solutions Group here at JP Morgan Asset Management. If you're listening to the audio version of this podcast, you can now watch along on YouTube by tuning into our JP Morgan Asset Management channel, linked to the show notes. Now let's get started. Phil, welcome to Insights Now.
Thanks for having me in such a big week. Although I will tell you, David, I'm still reeling from my embarrassing Yankees loss in the World Series. I know that doesn't affect you.
Well, you'll get over it, Phil. So listen, before we get into asset allocation, looking forward into 2025, what's your base case economic view?
Yeah, so David, it's a really good time to be an asset allocator right now for a couple of reasons. First of all, we think there's just still remains an incredible opportunity to take advantage of this economy that continues to be incredibly resilient. We've been overweight equities pretty much all year. Remember, it was a year ago almost, on November 1st of last year, where the Fed saw enough evidence to pause their tightening cycle. And we really took that as an opportunity to get overweight equities. So we've been overweight equities for the better part of the last year. I'd say over the summer, things started to shift a little bit because, as you said, not only have the Fed saw enough evidence to pause their tightening cycle, but they were starting to prepare the market for an ease. And the hope of a soft landing was becoming a reality. In October, I would say we got some of the best data that we've gotten in a long time on the U.S. consumer. And I tell clients this all the time. If you can get the U.S. consumer right, you can get your asset allocation right. Plain and simple. If the U.S. consumer were a country, we'd be bigger than China. Consumption is 70% of the U.S. economy. So what do I specifically mean in October? First of all, we got a revision in the savings rate. Mm-hmm. We found $1 trillion of extra savings that we didn't know existed. And I think that was a pretty big signal for a lot of folks that were cautious. Secondly, consumption in the third quarter, strongest since the beginning of 2023. And then on the soft data side, we saw the biggest jump in consumer confidence in the last month since the first quarter of 2021. Mm-hmm. First quarter of 2021 was the reopening of the economy, David. So this jump in consumer confidence, and this was all before the election. This is all pre-election stuff. Either candidate was going to inherit an economy that was strong and a consumer that was strong, which we think is setting up really nicely for what lies ahead.
Now, having said that, mm-hmm. the U.S. equity market is trading at about 22 times forward earnings right now. Yeah. Does that give you some pause for thought?
Yeah, so the narrative that I'm going with here is U.S. exceptionalism, but a diversification of the U.S. exceptionalism. So in the first half of the year, it was the cap-weighted S&P that did so much heavy lifting. It was a great, great trade. I think what happens when you start to get a careful and methodical easing of financial conditions, particularly easing of interest rate policy, is you get a breadth story. Mm-hmm. So specifically, over the last month or so, we didn't add to cap-weighted when we added to our overweight. We added to mid-cap. And we added to the equal-weighted S&P. Mm-hmm. So if we're overweight the U.S., half of that overweight is in cap-weighted. We don't want to abandon that.
Yep.
We want to diversify the breadth of that U.S. story into places that aren't trading 21 times, like mid-cap and equal-weighted.
Now, having said that, and I get the diversification within the U.S., how are you thinking about the global equity opportunity?
Yeah, good question. So in a typical 60-40 type portfolio, David, we have about a 10% overweight to stocks. And while 80% of that is in the U.S., which I just walked through, On September 24th, we got an announcement from Chinese policymakers where they finally said, we actually have a property market problem, right? So until then, they were addressing everything except that. And three particular things that caught our attention: the drop in existing mortgage rates by 50 basis points, the drop in down payment for second properties, and then the direct payment, fiscal transfer to folks living in poverty in China. You line all those things up, and that created an environment for us where we didn't want to be underweight EM. Mm-hmm. We wanted to be overweight EM. It's not a China trade, but it is an EM trade where we have about a 2% overweight. I would also say the corporate governance reform in Japan specifically catches our attention. We write a lot about that in our long-term capital market assumptions. But even tactically, as we look into next year, as long as the Bank of Japan doesn't create the chaos that they created in the first part of August with the currency, you know, I think there could be opportunities in Japan as well. But we, our highest confidence view is really hard to fade the U.S. exceptionalism story, but we are picking up selective opportunities abroad.
Let's talk a little bit about fixed income. Yep. So obviously we've seen rates move up, you know, later in the last few months and after the election. But can fixed income still play its role as a diversifier in a portfolio right now?
Yeah. So as a multi-asset investor, this is probably the most important question because it's how we protect ourselves. Since 1962, the data is on your side for fixed income being a ballast when it pertains to inflation. If inflation goes from above 3 to 3, and then settles below 3, which is in the range of what we're seeing now, David, right? Headline CPI obviously is below 3%. Fixed income has proven to be a diversifier. It has a negative correlation. That's part of our soft landing thesis, is that you have interest rate volatility and all macro volatility, you know, moving lower. So that's one thing that's on our side. The other thing I'd say, David, is why are rates rising? If they're rising because growth is low and inflation is high, that's different than why they've risen since the middle of September. So since the middle of September, we've seen an 80 basis point move higher in rates. So basically 360 to 440 on the 10-year note. That's 80 basis points. And the S&P 500 from September 16th, which was the low, to yesterday, the close of yesterday, is up 5%. The 10-year note went up by 80 basis points, not because of runaway inflation like we saw in parts of 2022, but because of those comments I was making earlier about the data we received on the consumer, on the labor market, on retail sales, on third quarter GDP, and then forward-looking GDP that we still think acts above trend. Our base case here is that fixed income will continue to act as a diversifier in a world where we have this soft landing view of roughly 2% growth, 2.5% inflation, and the Fed continues on this careful and methodical trip lower on rates.
So if inflation is low, then bonds should zag when stocks zig.
Yes.
And so you do get that diversification benefit.
Right.
And we were completely in alignment there. But how do you think about duration and credit? I mean, credit spreads seem to be pretty tight. And I don't know if a 10-year yield in the mid-4s is really that high. I mean, do you want to make a bet on duration or credit at this point?
So duration, no. Credit, yes. So on duration, we're neutral, our index. We would much, much rather, David, play offense in fixed income than defense. Defense means go add to duration because you may believe that growth, particularly, may be below trend, close to zero, or your risk of recession is rising. David, our recession probability over the next 12 months is 15%. Mm-hmm. That's as low as we could possibly make it. You can never assign a zero probability to any event. In any 12-month forward-looking period, there's always at least a 15% chance of recession, and that's where we're at. And we were at 20% in September. So we dropped that. That leads us back to credit. And credit is... credit has been the signal through the storm. If you look at 10-year rates, I just said 10-year rates backed up by 80, and they rallied like crazy leading up to the September Fed meeting. The federal funds futures market, which I know we all look at, has seen major, major whipsawing in the amount of easing or tightening over the years. But the credit story, the spread, the high yield particularly, spread has been an incredible signal. Right now, high yield spreads, admittedly very tight. This is not a trade where we want to hit a home run. We would rather get the total return on the equity side. High yield spreads are trading probably going back to 08 in about the fifth percentile. Very, very tight. Mm-hmm. But you know what's trading at the 50th percentile, right around average? All in yield. because the treasury rate is higher than where we were in the previous cycle. So we're asking high yield to do is to give us a less glamorous form of alpha, which is just out-yielding the ag or the index, which we're up against. And then a couple of things, you know, you guys do a great job in the guide to the markets. A couple of slides that I think are really impactful on the high yield market. Don't call it junk bonds. Mm-hmm. It's as least junky as it's ever been. Half of the index is double B. It compares to 08, where roughly 30% of the index was double B. Private credit has taken all of that low quality out of the high yield index. And then just like, David, the U.S. consumer in years like 2020 and 21, they may have had to put a mask on or Zoom with their mortgage broker to refinance their mortgage. But if they were a CFO, he or she went into the office and refinanced a lot of their balance sheet. So you guys have great data on the amount of the high yield index that has to come to issue this year, only about 1%, next year about 4%. Mm-hmm. So we're not seeing this wall of issuance. So from a fundamental standpoint, no recession. High yield is a no recession trade. That's one thing of why we like it. And then from a technical standpoint, the low issuance and the high quality continue to point us to this trade. And we want it to be like paint drying. Mm-hmm. We just want the extra yield in the background over our index. And then we'll go try to find the alpha and the security selection and the all of the, you know, overweight to equity for the total return in the portfolio.
So in other words, the attraction in fixed income is that it is attractive fixed income.
Yes, that's right. Attractive fixed income. And again, I don't extend this, David, to mortgages. I don't extend it to investment grade corporate bonds. This is a high yield trade that we're employing versus anything in the core bond universe right now.
Listen, obviously we've had a very good year for the equity market and a good year for the economy too. The U.S. economy has performed very well. But of course, the things that go wrong, and you must think about all that. So as we head into 2025, sort of finally, what are some of the risks that you think about?
Yeah. So what we walk through over the past few minutes, David, and the past few questions is the base case. Okay, that's under the bell curve, right in the middle, and then you have tail risks associated with that bell curve. And the left tail, I addressed it. We only have a 15% chance of recession. We define recession, obviously, as two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth with negative job creation. Okay, that's the left tail, and we have a very low probability of that. I think what keeps us up at night is actually the right tail. So the right tail would be, okay, we have a new administration that has, you know, two kind of offsetting things going on. The first is deregulation, which should support risk taking, and we saw a lot of that on a lot of that price action right after the election. But the other piece that you have on the other side of that is something that can be inflationary in terms of, you know, uncertainty around tariff policy or around fiscal policy. So what keeps us up at night? The risk of the right tail would be if the Federal Reserve had to come in and say, I know we were easing policy, but we now have an environment where the benefit of this careful and methodical takedown of the federal funds rate does not outweigh the cost of a potential acceleration of inflation due to uncertainty. Okay, that would be an environment where the 10-year note was going up for the wrong reasons, possibly because of inflation. And I think the 10-year note is going to be our traffic cop, almost like a traffic light in terms of taking risk. Right now, as I walk through, a 4.4% 10-year treasury rate, David, isn't that concerning. Yeah. We've averaged about 4.2 all year, and the equity market is up over 20%. So we can deal with this. It's that chaotic move higher based on what's underpinning our view that the Fed can continue to cut rates. If that goes away and we have this uncertainty around inflation, you know, that would be something that would be a risk. And I would say kind of lines in the sand the way that I'm thinking about this. Headline inflation traveling above 3, unemployment rate traveling below 4, something like that, okay, would be an environment where, you know, similar to where they were a year ago, they just would not have the clarity to cut rates and make things less restrictive, which is, in fact, David, a linchpin to our view of this soft landing trade and being overweight equity.
And I completely agree with you in terms of that certainty does seem to be the risk to our view also. Mm-hmm. But we always say that, you know, when you put together a list of risks, that I always leave a space at the top for the most dangerous risk, which is none of the above.
Yeah.
You know, this century has seen plenty of things that nobody expected that can really damage the economy. And of course, that's why we believe in multi-asset portfolios and investing.
And David, back to bonds. You know, 2022 was so was so hurtful for multi-asset investors because it was the perfect storm for fixed income. It's not just because rates went up why the ag was down 13%. Rates went up quickly from a very low level.
Yep.
So even if we do get this trip up to 5%, if you're starting at 4.5%,
the more normal rates,
you have that cushion of coupon that was so missing in 2022, which is again why the ag was down. So it would be a little bit like 2022, but to say the ag would be down 13% again, you would need to tell you know to go to 8%.
So in short, 2025 should still be a good year to be invested broadly in long-term assets.
Yes. I mean, we're talking about above-trend growth and a pro-cyclical story. And as I call it, the Benjamin Button cycle. It's a cycle that's aging backwards. It's not, we think we're in mid-cycle. We don't think we're in late cycle.
All right. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining
us,
Phil. On our next episode, I'll be joined by Gabriela Santos, Chief Market Strategist of the Americas, to share our latest view on the markets and the economy following the 2024 election. To all our viewers and listeners, thank you for tuning in today and speak with you soon.
This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.